A vast barrier snaked out of San Francisco on Saturday on a mission to sweep tons of plastic out of the Pacific Ocean. This is System 001, developed by The Ocean Cleanup, a Dutch non-profit organization. They're calling it the world's first ocean cleanup system. It's being towed 1,200 nautical miles offshore to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, an area between Hawaii and California containing 1.8 trillion pieces of plastic.
Australia's Perth Mint recently released the most expensive gold coin in its history, valued at $2.5 million. The Discovery coin is made up of 99.99% pure gold and has four argyle pink diamonds. The stones alone are worth about $1.7 million. The entire coin weighs about 4.5 pounds.
According to reports, the owners of Cadbury's Mondelez are stockpiling chocolate, cookies, and ingredients. It's in preparation for a no-deal Brexit in March, which could cause chaos at the borders and a shortage of key goods. It might not happen, but at the moment there still isn't a deal, and the clock is ticking.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here with us on this Monday, September the 17th. It's 5:10 in the morning. We've got a good show for you on this another business day and a new edition of The Opening Bell for this Monday. Our CEO spotlight is this morning. John Holmes is here. He's the CEO of AAR Corporation out in the suburbs, the aviation services company. We're going to bring in John momentarily. He's out in the PPG Paints green room waiting. We'll do him in our first segment this morning. And then second segment this morning belongs to the hurricane. We're going to talk about the economic impact of Hurricane Florence, not just in the hurricane zone, but for the rest of the country as well. That's about 5:40 this morning. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward a weak open later on Wall Street, with Dow futures off down about 35 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are lower as well. As we look around the rest of the world this morning, markets generally are lower in Europe, with the FTSE off by about a third, the DAX in Germany off more than a half a percent, and the CAC in France off by about a third as well. In Asia, markets are generally lower as well. The Hang Seng off nearly a percent and a half, down 353 points. In Asia this morning, oil is trading at $69.53 a barrel, which is up about 54 cents. A couple of stories before we begin this morning. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that President Trump is going ahead with plans to announce new tariffs on about $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. The report comes after the White House invited Beijing to hold new talks on their tariff dispute. Last week, the president told reporters such a move could come soon. The Journal cites unnamed sources as saying that the matter, that the tariff level will likely be set at 10%. That's below the 25% announced earlier this year. Two governments have imposed 25% tariffs on $50 billion of each other's goods so far. Beijing has issued a list of about $60 billion of American products for retaliation if Trump's next tariff hike goes ahead. This new round of tariffs could impact electronics and other items that are pretty popular as the year comes to an end for holiday shoppers. We'll see what the impact on the economy is going to be from that. Drivers for the ride-hailing company Uber are frustrated over a glitch that is keeping them from being paid immediately. The report says that Uber is still working to fix the problem that was reported on Friday, apparently. Uber spokesperson says the company's identified an issue with its instant pay feature, and the drivers will be paid eventually. Instant pay allows drivers to be paid immediately for the rides that they take instead of delayed. The news organizations that have been reporting this say that Uber has declined any further comment on what might be happening. It's not known what caused the issue, when it actually began, or how many drivers were affected by this. Well, the CEO of AAR Corporation is in our CEO spotlight this morning. John Holmes is here, AAR, an aviation services company. John, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve.
Congratulations on your post as CEO. You've only been in the job a short time, right, as CEO?
That's right, yeah, effective June 1st, and extremely excited to take on the role.
We'd like to begin our CEO spotlights by asking a little bit about the company, just in case people aren't familiar with it. Give us an idea of what AAR is all about.
Yeah, happy to. AAR is an aviation services company, and we've been in business since 1955. Today, we're about a $2 billion revenue company. We have 6,000 employees in over 20 countries, and we do business with pretty much every airline you've ever heard of. And we do three major things. We sell parts. We sell new and used parts to save our customers money. We repair parts. We also repair entire aircraft. So we're the third largest in the world and the largest in North America in terms of heavy maintenance on aircraft. And then what we do is we take those two things together, selling parts and repairing parts, and we wrap those under long-term contracts, which we call supply chain programs. Mm-hmm. And we sell those both to airlines and government customers around the world.
I have in my hands your 2018 annual report. And the headline,
isn't that beautiful?
It is. It's very nice. There's a nice big aircraft in the front of it. It says win-win.
Win-win.
So that's going to be my next question. How are things going at AAR?
Things are going great. Yeah. Things are going great. Yeah, we're on a May fiscal year end, so June 1st started our new fiscal year, FY19. This is shaping up to be one of, if not the best years the company has ever had. We've won a tremendous amount of business in the last couple of years. We've really focused the portfolio of the things that we do in the services businesses to integrate our offering to the airline. So if we're selling you a part, we can offer you a new part or a used part. If we're selling you a repair, we can repair the parts that we're selling you. And then we, as I said, wrap those things up into long-term customers or long-term contracts. And there's an overall trend in the aviation industry to outsourcing activity. And we've been very focused on capitalizing on that trend. And as a result, over the last couple of years, we've won a tremendous number of commercial supply chain contracts that I mentioned earlier. We've also been taking those commercial best practices and applying them to the government space. And we've won several billion dollars of government contracts over the last couple of years as well. So it's really an exciting time to be at the company.
I'm going to get into a couple of those things, but let's talk first about the nuts and bolts part of that. So let's say, you know, you have a 737 or 767, whatever the aircraft is.
And we can do them all.
It breaks down. What do? Do they tow that over to your place, or do they fly it in, or do you go to them? How do the nuts and bolts of what you do?
That's a great question. So most of the work that we do is scheduled maintenance, and there's different levels of checks. So every year, every 3 years, every 10 years, the aircraft are scheduled for maintenance. And so we have seven different facilities here in North America. We're actually building another facility right now over in India. These are giant hangars, and we can take everything from an A380 down to a little regional jet. And so for those scheduled checks, we work with the customer to schedule the maintenance visits. And you know, we have a steady line of business coming in as a result of those scheduled checks. We do have what are called AOGs, aircraft on ground. And that means that something's gone wrong. And if it's a repair that can be completed in the field, sometimes we just send them the part that they need so that they can put it on the aircraft and take off and get the passengers where they want to go. And other times we have what we know are tiger teams, and we would dispatch a team to actually do a repair potentially on site.
I saw a fascinating documentary recently about aviation, specifically how that's done, how you roll an airplane in, and it's taken apart completely.
It is.
And
it's
put
down
that
to the. It's like your house. It's down to the studs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, talk to us about that process, because I just think that's fascinating.
It's a remarkable process. And I was out at one of our facilities in Oklahoma City 2 weeks ago, and we were doing an internal film on how this process works. And I got a chance to sit in the cockpit and actually run some tests on the aircraft. So you get up in the aircraft, and it's entirely torn apart. Yeah. Really, just the fuselage shell is there. And we were testing some of the flaps. And so, you know, I go through a series of tests. I power on the aircraft, and that was actually the first time I'd powered a commercial airliner before. And it actually dings just like your car, which was kind of a surprise. So we're testing this aircraft, and you know, one of the things that I had to do when I was in this cockpit was radio to guys around the aircraft to tell them, okay, we're about to test the right flap, we're about to test the left flap, and move these flaps up and down. But you're radioing everybody to make sure that no one's walking past.
Yeah,
because you don't want to hit anybody in the head. But it's a great deal of work. The processes are extremely, extremely detailed, And we have an incredible focus, as you would imagine, on quality and safety of flight. So the inspections, the rigor of the training that we go through for our people, those are all very, very important things as we look to maintain aircraft.
So somebody who's listening this morning who's a regular flyer, this is how the aircraft stays new and fresh feeling for 20 years.
That's right. You got to keep that thing operational. Another part of the business, though, is speaking of new and fresh, would be modifying cabins. So if you're flying on aircraft today, everybody's regularly coming out with new seats, new business class seats, new first class seats, new coach. Sometimes they're wide. Sometimes, there's a new entertainment vehicle. We do a lot of that work, too. Working with our airline customers. Sometimes we help them design the new interior, and sometimes we help them install the new interior. But that's a fun part of the business.
Yeah, and that's an interesting topic because, I think a lot of people are thinking right now legroom. That's the first thing probably people
yes.
are thinking about. Do you have a say in that? Can you get us more legroom?
We do not have a say in that.
In all seriousness.
But we would love it if you supported the customers and bought that upgrade.
Right. So, yeah. But the serious question is how much more can they take away from legroom?
Well, they're moving to. There is a limit, and I think we've seen some of the larger carriers come out with, okay, this is it. We've gone as far as we're going to go. But they are moving more towards that premium economy. So adding that as a third class to the aircraft. So for an extra upcharge, you can get a few extra inches of legroom. On international flights, they've actually they've started to install a premium economy, which was really a domestic first class seat, but treated as an economy seat when you're flying overseas. So there's a lot of creativity around that. The other thing that's interesting is, the advances in seat technology is really fascinating as well. If you look at old airline seats, and we see old aircraft frequently, I mean, they're big, thick seats. So you had a lot of space just taken up with big, thick seats. But the technology to thin that down and still withstand or still pass FAA tests to withstand force of gravity, et cetera, has really come a long way. So the airlines are able to get a lot more seats with the same spacing, but just by shrinking the profile of the seat.
It surprised me. I knew you guys had a lot of employees in different places, but 6,000 folks.
6,000, yeah.
That's a pretty big number of people. And you have been hiring people hand over fist, haven't you, in the last year?
Quite a bit, yeah. It's been a big year of growth for the company. Our employee count has increased from about 5,000 over the last year and a half to about 6,000 today. We're enormously proud of all of our teammates. And a lot of what's driven that is some of the government business that we've won and the contracts that we've taken on in support of various agencies in the government has driven a big part of that that employee count.
Mm-hmm. I switched to a Forbes America's Best Employers list.
Yes.
You guys made it to that.
So yes.
Pretty cool.
We're thrilled about that. Yeah. We're so proud of that.
What is it about working at your company that you think may help you make it on this list?
We have a wonderful culture at AAR, and we're enormously proud of it. The number one word that employees would use to describe AAR, even though we're a big multinational company, is entrepreneurial. Mm. And that goes back to our roots. We were founded in 1955. It's a very classic American entrepreneur story where our founder, Ira Eigner, went out and bought some surplus radio parts. That's what AAR stands for, is Ira or Allen Aircraft Radio. And he bought some surplus radio parts and sold them out of the back of his Studebaker and started that that buying and selling business, which is the original business that started all of the company. And no matter how big we get, and I talk about this all of the time to people that work with us and people that we're looking to hire, is we never want to lose that entrepreneurial spirit. And we want to make sure that everybody inside the organization, regardless of their background, regardless of where they are in the organization, knows that they can make a difference and knows that if they have an idea that makes sense, that they can take this company in an entirely new direction. And if we had more time, I could tell you story after story about people in an area that may have nothing to do with their day-to-day job, but they come up with something, it gets implemented very quickly, and changes the course of the company, which is really exciting to be a part of.
It is, and it's it's refreshing, too, to hear that companies are putting people first again.
Absolutely.
There used to be a trend where that never happened. Why do you think that's important now? Is it something that the workforce is demanding before they even come on board, that they want to work in a company that has that culture?
Yes. And the hesitation was that's always been part of AAR. Mm-hmm. We've always had a focus on our people. A lot of companies say that your people is our greatest asset, or your greatest asset, but we really believe it. And as a services business, you know, we're not manufacturing things in large scale. We don't have a lot of intellectual property necessarily in the company. We're a services business. And the service that we're selling is largely labor and people to the airlines. And so we want to make sure that all of the people at the company feel like they're a part of something.
Here we are just about a week after 9/11.
Yeah.
There's an interesting story involving you in 9/11. You started at the company right around that time. It was a challenging period. Tell us the story again.
Sure. So I accepted the job the night of September 10th, 2001. And resigned my job, and I was working in investment banking prior to going to AAR. I resigned my job the morning of September 11th, and we all remember where we were on that unfortunate day. But for me, I was leaving a career in financial services and moving to aviation. And needless to say, that was one of the toughest times in the history of aviation and the toughest time for AAR. So when I joined the company, our revenues were about $1 billion, and within about a year, I believe, we had lost about 40% of that revenue thanks to the downturn in aviation. And I was hired to do mergers and acquisitions work for the company. And needless to say, we weren't going to be going out and acquiring a lot of businesses during that period of time because, candidly, we were looking to survive. And we were selling businesses, we were raising capital in the markets, we were retrading our renegotiating our debt deals, we were doing sale and leasebacks on our buildings, we were doing all sorts of things to raise capital to make it. And AAR is very unique in the commercial aviation space. We've been in business, as I said, since 1955, but we've only been unprofitable for 2 years, and those were the 2 years after after 9/11. But for me, it was an extremely impactful time because, as I said, I was hired to do a job that I really wasn't going to be able to do given the macro environment. And I would have been an easy person for the company to say, you know what, you know, we brought you in, circumstances changed, and you know, it's time for you to move on. But the CEO, David Storch, he hired me, and he knew he had taken me from a good job, and he showed me a tremendous amount of loyalty during that period of time. It would have been very easy to, like I said, to part ways, but you know, he took me under his wing and stuck with me. And that early display of loyalty is something that stuck with me, and I want to make sure it carries through the company as long as I'm around.
It must also be important for you now as CEO to have the experience of being in a company at one of the worst times.
Yeah.
When you now are arguably there at the best of times. That's
yes.
A good perspective to have, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Give us a sense of, you know, how you think about that in the current environment.
That's a great question. One of the things that has stuck with me from those early days and one of the things that David Storch, who hired me and I worked with for the last 17 years, very focused on staying conservative and running the company from the balance sheet. And David has been in the industry for a long time. I've now been in the industry for a long time. And you've seen cycles. And you've seen competitors come and go. People lose that discipline, that financial discipline. They follow trends, et cetera, and then they go away. If you look at a chart of who we were competing against 10 years ago and 10 years before that, it's a very different chart each time because people come into this business and go out of this business because they don't have that same financial discipline that that we have. And so starting at the company right after 9/11 and seeing and experiencing firsthand some of the toughest years the company's ever had, you know, definitely left a lasting impression and reinforced that need to be conservative.
What would you say are your challenges now at the company, if any?
Sure. One of the biggest challenges, and we've talked quite a bit about this in the market, is our ability to find skilled labor. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned, we've got seven different facilities here in North America, and we are those large hangars. It requires a lot of labor. We have thousands of mechanics, and we only want to hire the very best people. And finding the very best people that have the experience that we need in a robust economy such as the one we're in right now, it's proven to be a challenge. And a lot of industries that are experiencing a similar dynamic. But we are, in a lot of ways, selling that labor force, and keeping that labor force intact across all of our sites is definitely more challenging than it has been in the past. And the demand for these services, Boeing has put out some studies, Airbus has put out some studies, other research firms have talked about it. The demand for heavy maintenance is only going to increase, and we have a much greater number of mechanics retiring from the workforce than we have entering for the workforce. So this dynamic is expected to continue to be a challenge for some time.
Yeah.
And one of the things we're looking at, and this is another, I'd say, challenge, but really an opportunity for the company right now, is how we use digital to make our how we use digital in our businesses. And there's a huge amount of opportunity for a company like AAR. There's no one like us in aviation. There's no one that does all of the things that we do and integrates our services the way that we integrate them that is an independent, meaning not part of an airline and not part of a large OEM like a Boeing or an Airbus. Mm-hmm. We're the only guys out there that are truly independent. And that carries with it a tremendous amount of opportunity for us to be innovative and offer independent solutions to our airline and government customers. And we're very focused on digital and its applications in the aftermarket in aviation. And I'm excited about that. And I'm excited about how it might help us solve some of these labor challenges in the future.
Well, the labor challenges is one that, as you've mentioned, is one that's facing a lot of companies these days. You can only, increase people's pay so much. You can only, but when you have a double barrel of a tight labor market and the retirements like that, what has to happen there? Do you have to go out into the community, to community colleges, to find your workforce that's out there and kind of get them trained up and ready to come work for you? Is that the next step?
That's a big part of what we're doing. We are partnering in our seven different areas where we have facilities. We're partnering with exactly how you said local colleges. Mm-hmm. Working to develop new programs. AAR has worked with a number of schools to develop aviation training programs. We're also looking at making it easier for mechanics coming out of the armed forces to transition from their world to our world upon retirement, and working with the government on making on harmonizing the training program inside the DOD with what's required by the FAA to make that transition very smooth for our veterans. And then, as I mentioned, we're working on technology. It's early in a lot of ways, but whether you're using drones to inspect aircraft, whether you're using augmented reality to help advance the skill of the worker early on in the career, those are all things that we're looking at employing to deal with the overall trend.
You could only go so far with that, though, can't you? I mean, you almost always have to have those human hands in there working on those. You can't replace people with robots, can you?
We cannot, not in this business. We can enhance skill level with technology, but you can't replace people with robots, no.
We always ask our CEOs when they come in if there's been a moment in your career leading up to where you are now, sort of an aha moment that has either changed your course or propelled you to do something in a way that maybe you hadn't thought of before. Did anything come to mind?
When I think back about, when I think to my early days at AAR, I originally came in, as I said, to do mergers and acquisitions work. And I had a deal with David that I was going to be at the company for 2 years and I was going to go back to business school and likely go back to banking. At the end of my 2 years, he gave me an opportunity to move from the finance side of the business to the operations side of the business and run a small division inside the company. It was a division that had been struggling for a long time. And I joke now that, he gave me the shot. I was only 26 years old. He gave me the shot to run this business because it was so messed up, I couldn't mess it up anymore. It was an amazing experience to go from, really a financial analyst to a general manager with a P&L and a team. And I remember this moment at one of my first quarters. And, in a public company environment, you're driven to hit your quarters. And I'm sitting around with my team at a table in my office. And we had a tough quarter in front of us. And we had a lot of work to do in a short amount of time in order to hit the expectations. And I remember this very powerful moment where I looked around and I realized, wow, this is up to us. There's nobody else that's going to help us. There's nobody else that's going to come in here and make this easy for us. This is up to us. We've got to figure this out. And that up to us moment has stayed with me for a long time.
Let's talk about forward guidance. Anything out there on the horizon that causes you concern? Where do you think AAR is going to be in maybe five or 10 years?
I'm excited about where AAR is going to be in 5 or 10 years. I think that we've got three things that we're working on. One, I mentioned digital. Two, working to position ourselves to offer an even more integrated services offering for the airlines and the government. And then the third is international expansion. I mentioned earlier that we're building our first facility outside of the U.S. Over in India. It's a joint venture with a partner over there. But a lot of our physical work, our wrench-turning, if you will, activities is still done here in the States. And we've developed an extremely powerful brand. We've got wonderful processes and systems that we can deploy. And I'm extremely excited about what we can do to take that know-how and take it overseas and facilitate other parts of the world. And if you look at where aircraft are being delivered, the Middle East and Asia, et cetera, that's where the action is going to be over the next 10 or 20 years, and that's where we want to be too.
John, it's great meeting you. All the best, everybody at AAR. We'll keep watching your success, and please come back and join us sometime.
Steve, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
John Holmes is the CEO of AAR Corporation, the aviation services company based out in Wooddale. You can find more about them online at aarcorp.com. We're going to continue our conversation with John after the bell this morning and post our conversation in the podcast of The Opening Bell at WGNradio.com a little bit later on this morning. This is The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Hi, this is Catherine Davis with today's NO Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoNO.com. Promise, a Chicago-based high-protein hummus startup, won second place at WeWork's Creator Awards in the business venture category, taking home $180,000. In total, nine winners received $888,000 at the event in Nashville. And Citibase, a Chicago startup that provides online payment technology and other digital services to governments, has been acquired for $160 million by GTY Technology Holdings. Citibase, founded in 2012, makes a software platform for government agencies that allows residents to search and paper things like parking violations, property taxes, and more online. That's today's NO Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoNO.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Monday edition of The Opening Bell. The impact of Florence is still being felt. Lots of evacuations ongoing. People still trying to save life, limb, and property this morning. But eventually, they're going to have to start counting the damage. And the question is, how will it impact not only the local economy there, but the national economy as well? Let's bring in Gina Smilek this morning, economy reporter at Bloomberg, for a conversation on this. Gina, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
And thank you for having me on.
So I guess the question is, and obviously first and foremost, our thoughts are with everyone who is still really trying to save themselves and their property and family and pets and everybody from all of this that's going on right now. But eventually they're going to have to start counting the damage. And the question is, well, does a hurricane like this impact the larger economy for the rest of the country?
Yeah, I think that's the question. Anytime we see a major weather event like this, from an economic standpoint, and usually what we see with hurricanes is they don't actually impact aggregate GDP data in the nation just because they're so regionalized. And so just to give you some numbers on that, North Carolina and South Carolina, which are obviously really bearing the brunt of this economy or of this hurricane, have a $730 billion economy together. That's less than 4% of U.S. GDP in total. And so even if it is a significant local impact, it won't have too much of a national impact.
So what kinds of things would we see that might reverberate out from the storm center here through the rest of the country? What kinds of impacts might we see?
So typically what you see with a hurricane, and this was certainly true of Hurricane Harvey last year, is you initially see a real pullback. So for the first month or two, you'll see things really slow down. You'll see initial jobless claims, for example, will shoot up in that area. Some manufacturing numbers might drop. Retail sales could potentially spike just before the storm and then fall off shortly after as people sort of hunker down. Sort of across a range of local economic indicators and potentially even up to the national level, you'll see some real dislocations in economic data. But then, as you get a couple of months out from the storm, what you'll see is a real pickup and even a surge in economic data, especially in things like retail sales, construction, and that happens as folks rebuild their homes. And so generally, sort of the pattern for hurricanes is a real short-term pullback and then a longer-term bump as rebuilding gets underway.
Was it different for Harvey because of the size of the states that were involved with that? Because with the car sales especially, lots of new cars were destroyed in that area, and it impacted the number of car sales. Does it depend on the state size? I mean, you talked about the GDP of North and South Carolina here, but Harvey was different, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The state size is hugely important, and also the size of the population centers that are hit. So Harvey, for example, hit Houston quite hard. That was important because Houston is not only a major metropolis, but a big production area, for example, for oil and gas and downstream industries. And so that had a little bit more economic potential to sort of shake the economy. That said, North Carolina and South Carolina together are actually larger than the size of the economy affected by Harvey. So it really sort of remains to be seen exactly which areas within that economy the hurricane affected. And since this is sort of a live storm and we're still assessing the damage from the last couple of days, I think it's going to be one of those things to keep an eye on, you know, whether things like car sales respond more or less than in a storm like Harvey.
We've been lucky, I guess, this year. There haven't been multiple storms yet. Let's hope it continues that way. But when does this gaming change? Are there models that show, you know, two storms, three storms all hitting the United States might impact the national economy, or no?
I think it's sort of the eternal answer in assessing storm damage that you kind of have to, it's so situation dependent. You know, you really have to look at what the storms are, where they hit, what their sort of flood, what kind of flood, flooding is the real economic damager. So what kind of flooding and wind damage comes along with them. And so I think those questions all would need to feed in. So it's hard to make some sort of simple economic model about it. I think one thing though that is worth being aware of is anytime you do have a really active hurricane season, you are going to have some funky economic data for at least the next couple of months. Now, whether that's a wash in the end will remain to be seen, but it will definitely make it harder to get a read on the short-term trajectory for the economy.
Gina, good information. We appreciate you being with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Gina Smilek, economy reporter at Bloomberg. You can read her stuff, and we'll link out to the latest story, too, at Bloomberg.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, we're looking for a week open on Wall Street a little bit later on this morning. Dow futures down about 35 points. NASDAQ futures off about a quarter. Gold and silver are trading higher. Let's get the latest on agriculture now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, all eyes are still on the agricultural sector of the Carolinas this morning after the weekend rains and winds. The good report from North Carolina is the fact that apparently the manure lagoons taking care of waste material from the hog operations withstood the storm and are holding their contents, keeping them from getting into the rainwater that is flooding the area. But of course, people have died and crops have been destroyed, and it's going to take a while to get back to anything near normal in that part of the country. A report this morning from Wisconsin that's on pace for losing the most dairy farms this year since 2013, not because of weather, but according to the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, Wisconsin lost 47 dairy farms in August alone. There were fewer than 8,400 licensed dairy producers at the beginning of this month, which is 429 fewer than at the start of the year. And, of course, one of the main, probably the main reason, are the economic conditions facing producers of milk and dairy products. Oh, there's one more big farm show on the schedule for this week. It'll start on the 18th, go through the 20th. It's the Ohio Farm Science Review, located at the Molly Caron Agricultural Center near London, Ohio. That's a three-day event starting tomorrow, going through Thursday. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. A couple more stories before we leave you this morning. General Motors is recalling about 41,000 pickup trucks and police sports utility vehicles because of loose brake pedals. Recall covers 2015 through 2016 Chevrolet Silverado and GMC Sierra 2500 and 3500 pickup trucks.
Chevrolet Silverado 1500 Special Service pickup trucks, and Chevrolet Tahoe Sports Utility Vehicles made for police departments and other government agencies. GM says the brake pedal pivot nut may loosen. A driver could be unable to stop the vehicle if the brake pedal is loose or inoperative. Time magazine is being sold by Meredith Corporation to Mark Benioff, a co-founder of Salesforce, and his wife. The Wall Street Journal reported that the iconic news magazine is being sold for $190 million, the sale occurring nearly 8 months after Meredith Corporation completed its purchase of Time, Inc. Now, the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for this Monday, September 17th. We'll get the Empire State Manufacturing Survey today. Also, Oracle and FedEx earnings, the iOS 12 software launches. And it's going to be a sort of slow week, but still a few things that could move the markets as we go through the week. General Mills and AutoZone earnings tomorrow. U.S. Treasury bond ownership stats are out as well. The Red Book due tomorrow, the Housing Market Index. On Wednesday, we'll get a look at mortgage applications and housing starts. Jobless claims on Thursday with leading indicators and existing home sales reports. Darden Restaurant and Micron Technology earnings on Thursday. And on Friday, S&P reclassification, new iPhones, and the Apple Watch hit stores. So plenty on the calendar for this week, and some things that could move the markets today on this Monday, September the 17th.